Thanks very much, Professor Samuel. I'll invite you to... Graham, yeah, invite you to take a chair. And our other panellists to come up, James Connors, Adam Jupp, Jamie Reed. And I'm going to give each of them a couple of minutes to make a statement or put a point of view. Can be partly based on what they've heard, but also they may well have walked into the room with a point of view that you do want to put for this session. So let me give a little bit of... I haven't got any background more than each of you that I've already said. So let me pass to you, James. Would you like to kick off with a point of view?
Yeah, look, thanks for your comments there, Graham. They're comprehensive. I think from my perspective and Medibank's perspective, we're in total lockstep on some of those issues that you raised. Certainly...
Premium increases?
Beg your pardon?
Premium increases?
I'll come to that. Empowering consumers to act in the healthcare market in the same way as they act in any other market is, to me, absolutely an essential facet of healthcare reform. Unless we can achieve that and make consumers the agent of change within the healthcare sector so that they are being actively involved in the decision-making around the trajectory of their care and what care occurs and the cost of it, then I don't see us getting out of the current paradigm. So I think you're entirely correct there, Graham. Insurers have a role to play in that. We can use the data we have as Medibank and Bouvera with RACS, for example, but we need access to other sources of data. And for those who are interested in this topic, the Productivity Commission is currently beginning an inquiry into the uses of data, and I think there's a strong imperative for this industry to make its voice heard in that, to make sure that the Productivity Commission considers the sources and uses of data to make healthcare more efficient in this country. I also agree entirely with you on prosthesis reform. I think you diagnose it accurately. There's no doubt, and there was some sort of laughter in the room, I think, as some of the examples you were citing came around. I don't think it's a laughing matter. I think it's an absolute travesty, the way that consumers have been overcharged for prosthesis devices for the last decade. And it has to change. I think the government has bought into the argument now that you were in the room for, of course, and people, representatives of the industry were in the room for earlier this year. It founded a little bit on the rocks of vested interest, unfortunately. You know, there's some powerful vested interests that profit from the current arrangements, and, of course, they made their voices heard. I hope after the election that their ability to influence the argument lessons and that we'll be able to see some positive reforms over the next 6 to 9 months. In terms of the capital question, I think the public debate that's happened over insurer capital since it publicised from the Credit Suisse report last year and from particularly during the premium round this year, I think it misses some important points. Insurers, it's nice in theory, but in practice insurers have to work within the Private Health Insurance Prudential Regulation Act. They have to work in accordance with APRA and previously to that, VIAC standards. And if you have a look at HS 110, for example, there's no reference in there to return on capital. It's not a condition on which insurers should be making their capital allocations. There is requirements in there to make sure that boards have an active role in determining the amount of capital that a fund holds based on their individual circumstances, their appetite for risk, and that is not the regulatory minimum that APRA sets. And APRA, I think, misrepresented APRA, actually, Graham, by saying that they advocate this as the proper amount for the industry. They don't. Even as recently as yesterday in an APRA forum here in Melbourne, they distanced themselves from that representation of that minimum capital standard as being somehow the appropriate amount of capital. In actual fact, it's well above that. They want to change the language they use of excess, which is being adopted in the media, because it's not accurate. So I think we just need a little bit of calibration of that argument, really. It's a proper thing for boards to make that decision about capital within the businesses. It's not proper for analysts, government, or outsiders to do that, in my view.
Adam.
Well, so I'd follow up those two. But in terms of this, I think really it was a lot of agreement and nodding and sort of disappointment that Graham stole some of my talking points. Maybe not the capital one, though. So just starting with that one, I think James is right that, you know, there has been some confusion about using the minimum level, and if anyone was operating at that sort of position, they would be getting sort of phone calls and knocks on the door from APRA. So we have to be careful around how we frame that debate and how we actually determine what an appropriate level of capital for the industry would be given the risks that individual insurers face. But in terms of the other discussion points, I mean, I was nodding quite a bit, so I think there is a sort of a need now to start simplifying and reducing some of the discrepancy between insurers, and the prime example of that is the standard information sheet for each product. So, for example, a hospital product, assisted reproductive services, while each insurer uses that category, what each insurer means by that category might differ slightly. So even if somebody is exercising their right to use portability agreements and transfer across insurers, they might be less with disappointment when they actually go to claim, because what was previously an approved procedure at their old insurer is no longer under the new one. So it would be nice to see either industry approved would be the best sort of approach for actually getting consistency across that definition. I completely agree with more data better. So I think, and that will lead to two things. One's increasing transparency, highlighting some of the efficiencies that we're seeing, particularly like the prosthesis debate and charging rates. And then also, it will just empower the consumer and let them decide whether that higher rate that they're paying is actually in line with their thinking about the better outcome that they might receive. And then on the provider side too, hopefully we'll see a reversion to mean or a benchmark price sort of appear just by making that data more available. And lastly, about the risk equalisation, I was wondering if we do have the proper incentives in the system at the moment. So over 40% of payments, hospital payments, are actually included in the risk equalisation pool at the moment. But it's a retrospective pool, so is that actually providing a sufficient incentive to insurers to improve the health outcomes of their members? And secondly, within that, are we actually allowing insurers to actually play within the right role that they should be to increase the touch points, especially with hospital cover, of their members throughout the year rather than that major life event where they may need to go to hospital?
Thanks, Adam. Let's pass to you, Jamie.
Yep, I've, unlike James and Adam, I've got a couple of notes, so I'll open my paper up. But I did want to start off by stepping back and saying, well, look, why are we here? And the underlying issue to all of this today is affordability. So the reason the government engages people like Graham and, you know, others before him to look at PHI is because of the affordability issues. You know, other classes of insurance don't get these sort of reviews unless they've hit some challenge of affordability, unless they've hit some challenge of accessibility. And it's just worth keeping in mind that that's there, and that challenge isn't going away. So we all know in this room, reports of this nature, you know, sometimes they're acted on, sometimes they're tucked away and aren't acted on. But if you know, these issues aren't going to go away that Graham's mentioned, and I think, you know, as an industry, we'd be advised to sort of engage with this and you know, try and move some of these things forward, including the ones we don't quite like. Which leads us on to capital and profit. I guess the first observation would be Graham was very fair in this, in that he attacked profit or excess profit wherever he saw it, so prosthesis manufacturers, excess charges with surgeons. As Adam and James have said, excuse me, there's a little bit more to it. So what is the right level of capital? You know, there's a whole seminar on that. The analogy I was thinking of is maybe it's like safety features on a car. So, you take too many safety features off the car. You could run a car with sort of minimum safety features and it'd probably still get you to A to B. But you're in trouble if, you know, you hit some trouble, you have some sort of crash. You'd want some extra level of safety features. And obviously there's a level where that gets too much. The biggest risk, and we've made arguments about, you know, both sides, the biggest risk as I see in the profit issue is it's such a heated issue, it's an issue with so much passion in it, that the risk is all people do is talk about profit. And you see it in the media commentary, you know, almost every week. There'll be people out there in the general public who think all that's wrong with the health system is insurer profits. You know, everyone else, hospitals, doctors, device manufacturers, they all do it out of love. Their costs don't increase year on year. And I just wonder if we focus too much on it, you know, we miss out. So profit is at most about 5%. It's often lower. So if we're serious about affordability, sure, you might want to do something with the 5%, but you'd want to do something and then just move on quite quickly and focus on the other 95. And look, for what it's worth, maybe the rule should just be, you know, 0 to 5 is okay. If 5 is okay, go lower if you want, and then just move on. Maybe that's a bit naive, I don't know. Prosthesis price, thinking about the 95%, first of all, we need to explain why costs increase. So rather than every year, everyone acting surprised when another 6% comes along because nothing's changed in the system. So to be honest about the costs of the product and also the value people are getting beyond tax dodge, beyond join today, claim today. And then you come on to saying, well, those dollars that people have invested, let's spend them as efficiently as we can. Prosthesis pricing is obvious. And then information is obvious as well. And look, let's sort of embrace this call for better customer information, but let's just make sure it goes both ways. So it's information about products, information about insurers, information about hospitals and doctors.
Quick response, if I can, just on the one issue which I need to focus on, which is premiums. And I just don't want there to be any misunderstanding. There is no suggestion that the capital adequacy standard set by APRA is all you need. And in fact, in discussion I've had with APRA, it's quite clear, and from my own experience in pricing as a regulator, you need to have buffers, and all that's well understood. But whether you need the several billion dollars of excess capital buffers that are sitting there at the moment is the big question. And so that's why I suggested that the starting point should be to say, notionally reduce your capital, notionally reduce it to a level that at least is sitting at or around that set by APRA as the capital adequacy standard, right? Then having done that, set a return on that notional reduced capital employed by a return that's around the 12.5%. You might make it 13 or 14 to build some buffers in, but there's all those things, right? But keep in mind this, that if you look at those, if you notionally reduce the capital of the industry at the moment and of some in the industry purely to the capital adequacy standards set by APRA, and then you look at the return on capital employed, you've got a pretty big buffer there when the return on capital employed is 50 to 60%. You know, that's well over anything that, you know, I think there'd be a few that would be in the finance industry, the insurance industry, that would love to be getting returns of capital employed of 20%, let alone 30, 40, 50 and 60%. So all I'm saying is start using that as a guide. There is no suggestion that simply maintaining your capital at the level that is set by, originally by FEAC, now by APRA, as the capital adequacy standards is enough. That never is enough. But what they're saying is that's the safety level, that's the safety net below which you can't fall, otherwise you've got real trouble. Right? Build a buffer on top of that, but the buffer at the moment is just, I can't reach that high.
So I think everyone in the room is happy to hear you acknowledge that you need more capital than the APRA stated amount. You need your whole capital management plan to be enacted and followed. I bet there's still some debate about premiums. So we've got 25 minutes for comment, discussion, etc. Can I have a bit of a feel for who is going to ask a question, just so I know how to manage a bit of time here? We only got three in the last session, so just show your hand if you feel you might be going to ask a question, okay? Everyone is very scared. What happens is you get the first question and everyone thinks, oh, I should have asked. Okay. There'll be some easy hits on Graham on the premium side of things. And so I'd like to take a question or a comment on the issue of consumer complexity. How does a consumer possibly make good decisions? How can we get the consumer pressure operating more effectively to get competitive results in the industry? I'd like to take a question or comment in that area first of all, because it's the area that we've spent the least time on so far this morning. So anyone going to pick up that area?
Thank you. Stuart Oldfield, Field Research. I'll have a crack there. James, I think you made a reference to the fact that to get out of the current paradigm, we'll need some improved means of comparison for consumers. Would that be an ideal opportunity for Medibank perhaps to immediately start submitting its data to the two most popular comparison sites, being Compare the Market and iSelect, as a useful starting point for consumers?
Submit its data?
Just as a starting point.
To list on those comparison sites, is that
correct?
Well, you know, Medibank does list on iSelect through its AHM brand and through other...
The main brand, please.
It's a commercial strategy, which is probably outside of the scope of this discussion, but, you know, it's a commercial strategy that says that that consumers using iSelect are better pointed towards AHM rather than our main Medibank brand. So, I don't think that's a transparency issue. Our products are just as... Medibank products are just as transparent. If you contact the fund or look on the Medibank website, you can do a comparison between Medibank and any other health insurer. So,
you acknowledge that consumers are relying heavily on those two websites, and if you wanted to enhance their comparison, then that would be the easiest step from their point of view?
Well, possibly. I mean, iSelect and the other comparison sites don't necessarily compare all attributes of a product, which is one of the issues that we have with listing particularly our Medibank product on there, because it has a number of addendums to that product which doesn't compare across other products. So, you know, I don't want to run through them, but access to other services that Medibank offers. So we just don't think, we've taken the commercial decision that we don't think it's suited to that forum.
I might just jump in there too. Even in one of the most competitive IFA and comparator markets in the world, the UK financial services industry, there are still organisations whose strategy is not to go through the independent financial advisor network. It's not like Medibank isn't doing the right thing. It's a perfectly legitimate strategic decision. But on that note, Andrew Matthews has the microphone as well. So over to you, Andrew.
Yeah, Andrew Matthews, Medibank. I'll make a quick comment on that maybe it's little known, but it's promoted by the Minister. All our policies and everyone else's are on privatehealth.gov.au. Any consumer can go there and look at it. There's no commission, and absolutely 100% of the industry is there. So maybe, you know, it's along your lines, Graham, that needs to be improved as a comparator site. But let's not forget that iSelects and Compare the Markets are running a commercial business. They also take a commission for that. Not only are not all products there, you can in some cases pay a fee to get your product promoted on the front page. Yeah. I'd say privatehealth.gov.au does not do that. Maybe it could be improved for easier access, but it has one. All of our products and prices and the rest of the market are actually there and available.
A quick response to that. I'm pleased you pointed out what I tried to point out before, which is that iSelect and Compare the Market have got very significant conflicts of interest. And it was very interesting in the context of the consultation rounds that we undertook. One of the questions I asked in every one of those sessions was, how many have actually used iSelect or a similar site? And about, 50, 60% put their hands up. And I said, how many have actually chosen an insurance product as a result? One person out of all the consultation rounds we did through the whole week said that they had, and actually he was a doctor who actually went on to the doctor's insurance cover, so that was hardly a fair thing. The other thing I've mentioned is that I think even the government, the Department of Health would acknowledge that privatehealth.org.au is not satisfactory. I changed the word you use from maybe it should be improved to it certainly needs improvement, and that's the whole context of the comparator website that I'm talking about.
More comment from the floor on this issue?
No. Yeah, g'day. I'm Matthew Coase from HERMA, a peak body for 19 not-for-profit, member-owned and community-based private health insurers. I think, Graham, you've got some really good content in there from today. One of the good examples, I guess, of transparency driving consumer choices in the UK with MyNHS, it seems to work very well with hospitals and also medical practitioners. Ideally, don't we want to move to something like that in Australia, where you can compare private health insurer, medical specialist, hospital, and you might even be able to see some performance data on medical devices, like what insulin pump works best, and seeing prices and performance and putting some real scrutiny around that. Isn't that where we want to get at the end of the day?
Without any question. That's why I refer to the NHS, and what they've now done is extend that beyond the NHS through the Competition and Markets Authority now to the PHIM, which is the Private Healthcare Information Network. And it's doing all those things. It's a long, hard road because, of course, while the NHS have brought in the hospitals, they can do that easily. Bring in the practitioners a lot harder. And many practitioners have actually developed a process of saying, we'll allow you to put our data there, but you can't put it by way of a comparator. In fact, one of the common themes that was coming through in the various consultation rounds that we did was, look, we don't mind data being provided, but we don't want comparators. But comparators are all about making it easy for consumers to make informed choice. And providing the comparators are objective and can stand up to the integrity of the data analytics that's being used. You know, for example, mortality rates for hospitals is all very well, but they need to have some risk weighting built into them. So that, for example, if you've got a trauma centre, it's more than likely that the people that are admitted, I shouldn't say that, but it is a high possibility that people admitted to the trauma centre will die. Therefore, that ought to be taken into account in terms of risk adjustment. But I do remember, not so fondly, back in the early part of this century, it's being suggested by some of us that, in fact, mortality rates ought to be published in respect to hospitals, noting that there ought to be a risk adjustment. The loudest complaint and the most vigorous complaint came from, guess where? The AMA. And I'm trying to say to myself, why is it that the AMA would be concerned about telling consumers that if you enter a particular hospital, it is more than likely that you will exit in a box? It doesn't make sense, right? And they're the sorts of issues I think we're dealing with. So we're dealing with a whole changing culture. And the culture, changing culture is the expression I used over and over again, empowering the consumer to be able to make an informed choice.
Jamie, Adam, James, you want to add anything or say anything about this issue of consumer transparency and getting the consumer driving?
I think, again, we should step out of healthcare and just think about how people buy things generally. So people are less loyal to brands. They demand choice. They demand to shop around. The analogies of the TV were appropriate ones. So, look, this is coming. You know, I don't know who's going to do it or where they're going to do it. And I know there's sort of a couple around already in Australia. So, look, we just need to get on board and make sure we shape it and we get something out there of quality, because if we don't, you know, someone else is going to do it.
And can I take up on that? I'm sorry, but I think it's really important. You use the word we, and I strongly recommend that the private health insurance industry, the major insurers, those involved with HERMA, those involved with the Not-for-Profit Alliance, start to get together and start to do this proactively, because there will be a point of time, whether it is with the current minister or a different minister, whoever it might be, whether it's the current government or another government, no one knows what will happen July 2nd, but that there's a point of time at which this whole process is going to build up the pressure. And it seems to me, I've always taken the view, and I know I've expressed it to some of you before, that it'd be far better off if you actually got together and said, let's do this. I can guarantee you that the ACCC will have a very positive view to anything that is done in the public interest. And if you look at their report, they'll show you what it is that is against the public interest that's troubling them now. That's why I read out those introductory paragraphs.
I think that's completely correct. I think the thing we also need to worry about or just be clear about is health is obviously a very, very emotive issue. And obviously when these events occur, you're feeling a bit pressured and sort of relying a little bit more on, you know, your GPs, the surgeons to know best, because they're the ones who are informed. So I think that what we need to recognise, what the challenge for health insurers will be, is that there will need to be a point where they'll need to invest in creating a loyalty to stop switching, and then also need to create a support network to actually help people through these times and give them that transparency. But obviously there's the concerns then with overstepping what becomes advice in terms of the medical best outcome for the health insurer in terms of surgeon selection.
I think I covered off my spot moment in comments, totally in lockstep with Graham, totally agree with you, Matthew. The question is how we get there. So Medibank has chosen the path of trying to work with the doctors. I don't think that you can really achieve these things in opposition from them. Mm. And that means changing the sort of the very old culture of medical practitioners working in their own individual silo where they, lord unto themselves and their patient. If we antagonise them by going too far too fast, then they will close ranks and withdraw from the process. So, unfortunately, I think it will be slow. There could be government-inspired sort of leaps. If, for example, the government turns open its NPS and Medicare data stores for insurers and academics and others to use in creative ways, then we can easily sort of cover some steps in a single bound. But I do think we need to be partners with the medical profession, not doing this in an antagonistic way.
Okay, I'll throw it open to wider topics. Bronwyn has her hand up.
I guess my topic kind of links to the back end of where that conversation went. So I'm Bronwyn Hardy from Teachers Health Fund. There's been a lot of talk today about improving consumer health literacy and letting consumers be able to advocate for themselves more efficiently. I've heard that talked about for a couple of years now in health insurance. It's been a growing topic. But I haven't heard it talked about outside the private health insurance industry. I haven't heard it talked about at many broader health summits. And I don't think it's something health insurers can do on their own. I think we need to do it in partnership with government and with other bodies. And my question is anyone seeing it happening anywhere else? And does anyone have a good approach for how we can try and partner with other people to make that work?
Well, I think it is happening. I think Dr. Google has been the single biggest advance in health literacy. People will routinely Google their symptoms, their condition, their diagnosed condition, their pharmaceuticals, and find out more than they would have prior to Dr. Google's advent. So I think there's a by osmosis, it's happening anyway. Is there a way to push that along? I'm sure there is. Should we educate children about health more than we do? I don't know the answers to those sort of questions, but I think insurers do have a role in making sure that our customers understand their health conditions, and particularly when we know they're going into hospital for a particular condition, to give them as much pre and post information as we can. Paul referred to things like better discharge procedures and things like that. That's part of it, and a really actionable area, I think, for insurers to work upon. So there's concrete things we can do.
I think it's letting people know that they can shop. So when you buy a car, everyone knows, you shop around, you try a few, you haggle a bit. But whereas, so everyone does it, it's accepted. Whereas for medicine, it's just feels out there. So I think when you start putting up these particularly official industry or government comparison sites, I think that's almost the green light to people to say, well, look, this is just a product you're buying. You can have a negotiation.
There are two sources. One is the GP, but the GP is constrained currently because of the whole funding model, the payment model. You know, 6 minutes, $37.50 or thereabouts, and so you've got to get a really dedicated GP that will spend the time to educate you, and that will spend the time, for example, if they've got access to a qualitative metrics website that says, look, I know you've got to have a hernia operation. There are 20 surgeons here, and there are five or six of them that are charging well over the odds, so let's discard them. Of those that are charging average, I don't like this guy Edelston, I don't like Patel, so I'll cross them off the list, but there are a whole series of others there that look all right. Now, who are you insured with? If it's private health insurance, right, which hospital? That hospital shows lengths of stay about double that of any of the others, has got reports about nursing care that's pretty poor. Let's cross that list to help you through the process. Back in 2000, 2001, along with Simon Blair, who's now with the Commonwealth Bank, but he was back then the CEO of the Inner and Eastern Healthcare Network in this state, and I was the chair of it, we prepared a paper, which I actually delivered to the World Bank, on a structure of reform to the health system, which interposed health service advisors. Health service advisors were there who had no other role than to give you advice as to what you should do, where you should go. They were there to perform that particular function. Now, in terms of private health insurance, that in many senses is what a private health insurer ought to be able to do, is an enhanced service. In terms of the public system, well, Again, you're relying in part on GPs, but there is absolutely no reason why governments, in terms of the public system, can't establish health service advisors that are there to provide that interconnection, that interrelationship, and to give you some assistance. So when I rang the insurance company to look at changing my insurance, and I said, am I covered for interoception or fund application? I knew what they were. Interestingly, they didn't. And it seems to me that if I'd said, well, twisted bowel, for example, or hiatus hernia, which is what fund application, right? Dealing with those sort of things, that might have assisted. But it's those sort of issues, I take an interest in it. I guess many people in this room take an interest in it. It's amazing how many people out there in public land just simply say, my doctor said to me, go to this surgeon. I went, and thank heavens I woke up after the operation.
Is there another question? I've got one in the middle there and then one over here.
Anthony Cloran from KPMG. On the capital side, APRA's pretty much put out that there will be a roadmap to change or consult on capital in a few years' time on some new standards. Given how short-tailed PHI is, how there's already, in a sense, some safety nets in Medicare, there's already the risk equalisation, so collaboration, do you think there's any argument that it should actually have a lower capital standard than other insurance types?
It's great to get a hardcore actuarial question at this stage of the proceedings.
I'll stay away from that one personally.
So. Look, I think, as others have said, the regulator sets the minimum, which is, the absolute danger point.
It's a safety point.
The safety net, I suppose. And they can... they can set it where they like, I suppose, and they benchmark to other industries and so on. But that's not really what drives what people hold, I guess, ultimately. And perhaps there should be some competition between, some insurers are very, very, very well capitalised, others run it a bit more skinny. And maybe that sort of competition is what we should encourage, given it's all competition above the safety net.
I think the only thing I'd add there is about 3 or 4 years ago, there's a couple of ex-FIAC actuaries in the room, so they'll be able to tell me, but the capital standards did change. At that point, there was quite a reduction in the minimum capital requirement as set by those standards, whether it could continue going further, but I think the capital standards at the moment picks up fairly heavily on the main driver of capital risk, which is growth and then variability in the net margin of the industry. And like you said, unlike other insurance, so general insurance, for example, we don't have that catastrophic risk element where an earthquake or something will lead to a large claim event.
So that's the actuary's view. Now, what about the non-actuaries?
Well, I'm a bit bemused, actually, because the immediate response from my colleagues here on the panel to my comments about capital adequacy was, oh, look, you don't understand. The capital adequacy is barest minimum. We've got to have well above that. You're suggesting we actually should take it even lower still. So I'm not going to comment on what Wayne Byers and his colleagues would do at APRA, but I think that their role is to ensure that when I take out insurance, when you all take out insurance, and something does happen that you're actually covered and they won't deal with failure. Now, you've got to remember this, that some of the reforms that I've suggested and some of the others that might well take place will put some pressure on some of those, for example, that are represented by HERMA or the Not-for-Profit Alliance. It'll put some pressure on those because they are smaller insurers who may not be able to sustain themselves longer term with lower returns on capital employed or the like, and some of them won't have capital employed in terms of their not-for-profit status. So there are some issues there, and that may well lead to some consolidation in the industry. Now, I'm not one to either to advocate or to reject consolidation. The only comment I'd make is that in the interest of consumers, I don't think consumers ought to be indirectly subsidising an industry to maintain the presence of insurers that might not otherwise be sustainable in a normal market environment. In the end, we rely on APRA to maintain capital adequacy standards for insurers, for private health insurers, for banks, and the like, and I'm prepared to leave it to Wayne Byers and his team of experts there to be able to set those.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to be a panellist for 30 seconds. I see absolutely no case for the chance of a health insurer going bust being any different at all from the chance of a general insurer going bust. So, of course, with health insurance, it'll lead to lower dollars of capital. But the capital requirement should be the same chance of the consumer failing to have their promises being kept. And now I'm going to go back to being chairman again, excuse me. And there was a question down here.
Yes, my question is for James. You made reference to the fact that certain people of influence were able to effectively block potential prostheses reformed in recent times. You also made mention of the fact that perhaps post the coming election that might change. I'm going to guess that those people of influence hedged their bets with both major political parties. So I'm just wondering if you could perhaps have some insight on how that might change post the election.
Well, you know, there was a lot of rumours circulating in the sort of April, you know, March-April period, I guess, about the trajectory of prosthesis reform. And it pretty quickly became apparent that there's, you know, we know from the structure of prosthesis funding that there's a supplier that gets a really strong commercial profit on selling their products in Australia, and then there's another, you know, the hospitals that intermediate the market, and they do pretty well. Some in particular do quite well, others are less focused on it. So you don't have to sort of think too far about who those interests might have been that seek to slow down the reform process. I think in a sort of a pre-election political cauldron, the ability for some of those interests to maximise their leverage over the process is there, and in the calm that follows an election outcome, depending on who wins, of course, this process could die, cease completely if there's a change of government. But in the calm that follows the re-election of government, then there's a bit more freedom to act, I think, in the face of some of their maybe benefactors.
Can I make a comment? And like James, I was a participant in some of the consultations that took place, and I don't think we should assume that any particular group had a greater influence on government, Department of Health, Minister, as the case may be, than the other group. And so I want to. My observation is that I should disabuse you of that notion. I don't think that was the case. I think James has made the appropriate comment, which is that the consultation process in respect to the prostheses list was done as we entered the cauldron of an election. And that makes it very difficult for any process of reform in a whole range of areas to take place. I've been involved in reform in too many areas, in a whole range of areas since the early 1990s, National Competition Council, like all focusing on competition. And the one big issue that has been difficult to persuade governments and vested interests about is that the fundamental predominant interest that we ought to be taking into account is that of the consumer. Now, when you go into a consultation or reform round, I'm strongly of view based on, I have to say, many decades now of experience, that you go in knowing the outcome you want to achieve and you say, this is what we're going to achieve as the result of this process. Now, the purpose of this consultation is to work out the way we get there. But let's have no mistake as to what it is that we're going to achieve. Now, I think as James will attest, that probably wasn't the process of consultation that occurred in relation to the prosthesis list. That was the process there was, well, I got 20 of you around a table. Let's see if we can reach a deal, if we can reach an accommodation. That's not my view, frankly, as to how you bring about reform. You say, this is what I'm going to achieve, and make no mistake about my determination that that is what we'll achieve. Now I'm prepared to sit with you and to work with you to get to that outcome in a way that achieves that result, but in a way that also accommodates some of your interests and some of the political imperatives that are associated with it. It's two different ways of undertaking reform. I happen to take a view that the way I've expounded is perhaps the better way. It's born of reviewing 2,100 anti-competitive pieces of legislation through the national competition policy reforms that we did from 1995 through to 2003. And we achieved an awful lot there by simply saying, this is what's going to happen. In the few areas where reform didn't take place, and we well know them, they've been outlined in the Harper report, pharmacies, taxis, things like that, no government was prepared to say to the vested interests, understand, this is what's going to happen. Why is it happening? Because it's in the interests of consumers. It's in the public interest. That is the dictate of what was then the Hilmer reform package and of what is the Harper reform package. And so if governments, and it was quoted in this morning's paper, that I think there are three C's involved in reform. One is conviction. Know exactly what you want to achieve and have conviction. Two, have the courage of your convictions. And three is communication and consultation, working with the parties, but understanding that the first two are there. Absent any one of those three, and you won't get reform.
Okay. On that note, I'm going to draw the morning to a close. I think it's been a brilliant morning myself, and as not one of the organising committee, I'd just like to congratulate each of them for what I think has been a terrific morning. We've had excellent speakers, and I'd like to thank the panel now for that. Just a couple of concluding remarks, and I'm going to pick up Graham's last bit about you go out there saying stuff will happen, let's consult about how and what unintended consequences we need to manage and so on. So you can take fairly strongly, I guess, that the economic basis for premium increases in the industry, there's going to be deep pressure to strengthen the understanding of that economic basis. We saw it enacted in the last premium review, and it was everyone in that process kind of learning that actually that was what they were trying to do. So it had a lot of loose edges, right? But the economic basis for why any particular premium increase is necessary, that's going to happen. The issue is how and what comes as a result of that. Second thing, prostheses. There is going to be a change in prostheses, right? The government hasn't announced things, but you can just read the signs of the times that while there's nothing final, there's definitely going to be something happening, and we'd generally welcome that. Thirdly, the consumer and complexity, another area where something will happen. There's no announcement yet, but we just know something will happen, don't we? So the issue is, how is it going to happen? What are its effects? What is the best way for it to happen? A lot of scope there for people who know what they're doing to inject into the topic what they think should happen. And that brings me to my final summary point. On each of those, we've sat here this morning and heard things about the overall system. We've heard things about details of the system, consumers, the way the product should operate, etc., etc. We each now go back to our day jobs, but we've each seen Andrew Matthews' graph, and if we go back to our day jobs and all we do is focus on that bottom quartile, then, well, okay, missed opportunity, right? The aim that the Institute had in running this session today was to catalyse in our own way the industry towards thinking about the bigger things and the way it should be in the future, what the key issues are. And so if each of us goes back to our day jobs with whatever platform we have, clearly Cindy Shea has a massive platform. Somebody else might have a platform of influence which is just around their own company. Others might be a consultant and talk widely in the market but don't actually run a company to do it. Each in our own way has the ability to step outside of Andrew's bottom quartile, the easy day job, step into the middle bit, think about the issues raised today, think about what will happen and turn our minds to how is the best way for it to happen, what is the best result for Australians and the consumers. And I'd say that's the final word. Go back to our day jobs and do something about influencing the answer to that question. Thanks again to the panel.